tuning in to The Halfling and the Spaceman, Journeys in Active Fandom. We're having great conversations with people that have turned their love of fandom into something creative. We're fans talking to fans. And today we are excited to have a chance to talk with Bobby Nash. He's an award-winning author who also writes novels, comics, short stories, novellas, graphic novels. And he also writes the occasional screenplay. Welcome, Bobby.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for taking time out of your, I'm sure, very busy schedule to do this.
I love doing stuff like this. I love talking about the things that I geek out over. And yeah, so it's fun.
Cool. Well, let's get started. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay. Well, I am, as you mentioned, I am an author. I write novels, comic books. I've dabbled in screenplays. I've done some audio scripts. That's been pretty interesting. I did a few full cast audio things, which has been fun. I started out as a kid. I was a comic book fan. That was kind of my foray into the creative side of things. I had this grand dream that I would become a comic book artist. That was the goal. I missed it by a lot because it turns out I'm not quite good enough of an artist to be a comic book artist. But I started writing stories to have things to draw. And that was where my love of storytelling kind of started. And then I was able to eventually pivot it into something close to a career. So yeah, I'm my first published stuff, you know, professional published stuff was comics. I love it. I still love writing comics today. I do it as often as I can. But then, you know, from there, it was just like, gee, I wonder if I can write a novel. And so I tried and I wrote one and it was awful, but I wrote one and I finished it. And that's the big part that makes you want to come back and do it again. I finished it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was done, there was that great sense of accomplishment. And yes, even though I realized it sucked, I knew I could do it. So that allowed me the freedom to say, okay, let's do it again. And then the second novel I wrote, I sold to a publisher. So yeah, so that's kind of where I started. And I've been writing pretty steady since then. So,
okay. Well, just delving into your background just a little bit, were there any courses or classes that you took along the way that sort of helped you hone your craft?
Well, when I was in high school, way back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, that was when I was still had that comic book artist dream.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would sit in classes, and this got me in trouble multiple times. So I would have the school book open on one side of my desk, and there would be like typing paper on the other side, and I would be writing and drawing comics throughout the day. That was how I was spending my day. And there were two teachers in high school that caught me doing that. And instead of punishing me, said, hey, have you thought about like honing this creativity or doing something with it? One of those was my English teacher, who also was in charge of the school newspaper, and which I had never given half a second thought to. And she was like, come do some stuff with us. And so writing for the paper taught me things like, well, one, deadlines, you know, doing it on your own. You do it when the urge hits you, when the muse hits you, when, you know. So I started learning deadlines in high school, which has become a very important thing in my life, you know, today.
Sure.
But I also started learning skills. And now this was in the pre-computer days. You know, the computers were not as prevalent in schools as they are now. Man, that makes me sound really old. But
you're in good company.
But I learned how to put the newspaper together. Without, back then, we were doing paste up with rubber cement and all those, you know. But those skills are still skills that I use today. I just use a computer to do that job instead of rubber cement and scissors.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot in high school doing that stuff. And then when I was writing my second novel, The first one I attempted was a science fiction novel. The second one I was doing, I decided to do like a mystery thriller, which I love those. You know, I love reading those. And I took a non-credit course at the University of Georgia. It was one of those once-a-week nighttime courses. Yeah, it spoke to me. The title of this class was Murder and Mayhem for Fun and Profit. So, like, how could I not take this course? And the teacher's name was Harriet Austin. She had her own writer's conference as well. And we would write and bring our stuff to class, and then we would read it in front of class and her. So not only would we get her feedback, we would get feedback from the rest of the class, which, you know, for me, who was quite shy at the time, yeah, I grew out of that. but at the time, I was very quite shy. That was terrifying to me, was reading to people, you know. So that class had kind of a twofer effect. I learned things about my writing that I didn't know. I learned how important it is to, when you're doing dialogue, say it out loud, because it may look good on the page, but if you can't wrap your tongue around it, it might not work.
Mm-hmm.
And then being able to talk in front of 20, 30 people, whatever it was, which is also, those are all things that I didn't realize at the time that would become more important as I went along. Because now I do conventions where sometimes I'm on a stage and there's 200-300 people in front of us. And I can do that now because I was able to get past that shyness of not being able to read in front of a group. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot doing, and then a lot of it was just, beyond that, it's mostly self-taught. I've learned more from screwing up than probably anything else, you know. But I learned enough with those skills in those things. And since then, I've gone to writers. I've worked writers' conventions or writers' conferences. And I always pick up things. You know, I've gotten to meet from doing conventions and podcasts and et cetera, et cetera. I've gotten to know other authors. And you can learn a lot by seeing how other people do things. Or when you make those connections where it's like, when I run across a problem, you know, writing problem, I know I've got a handful of writers I can call up and go, okay, talk me off this ledge, or what am I doing wrong? Or, you know, mm-hmm. So it becomes that community building that really helps you learn a lot from seeing how others do it, both good and bad. And, you know, ooh, I don't want to do that. I don't like how they do, this person does that, or I love how this person does this. And so I learn a lot from watching and studying other writers, and not only writers, artists, actors, directors, et cetera. You know, seeing how, especially when it comes to interacting with people, when I do things like conventions, you know, learning how to talk to people. And a lot of that came from watching creators I admired, watching them and going, oh, that's how they act around people, you know, ooh, that's, you know, I like what they're doing. And so that helped a lot. But yeah, but mostly it's just, I screwed something up and go, ooh, I learned a lesson. And I, you know, that's.
Well, that's kind of life in general is, you know, you screw up and then you say, okay, I'm going to do better.
You'd like to think that was the case, but I've seen too many examples of it not being.
Yeah, we don't always learn from the mistake. Or sometimes I'm a slow learner. I make the same mistake 6 or 7 times before my brain goes, you know. So yeah, it's but you learn a lot. I mean, you really do learn a lot from those, and it's little things. It's not like the big things. It's like when I first started talking to one of the guys who was doing the production side of things. Because even though you're not manually typesetting, that stuff still has to be done to publish a book. And if you say at the end of a paragraph, have an extra space after the period, that throws off the formatting and it could cause like big spaces between the words. And so just in talking like to the production guy, he says, oh yeah, this is a pain that I have to fix this. And I was like, oh, I didn't know that. Okay. So now at that point I became cognizant of that. So I started looking out for it. So I stopped doing it and therefore made their lives easier.
Right.
But it also made my stuff more attractive to them as a publisher because we have to do less work to his stuff. So there's a lot of those type of things you learn as you're doing it. And the technology is constantly evolving. So you learn new things and try new things and learning design. I work with some great cover artists. And so when we're discussing what we want on the cover, you know, learning design elements. So I've picked up a skill or two there that now it's easier to tell them what I'm thinking because I know what a cover needs, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Things like when I started, I remember they always told us about covers, that a book cover, you should be able to read the title across the room. Like if you put the book on a bookshelf and you walked into a bookstore, you could see a title over there. You needed to be able to read it. And that's what grabbed your attention. Even though that's not as much today, it's still important because you're selling your books on Amazon. They're an inch tall.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be able to read it at an inch tall.
Right.
So that takes into account things like font sizes and types of block, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah. Right. Sorry, I'll ramble on about this all day.
No.
Good stuff.
It is good stuff.
Good stuff.
We've been off and on involved in publishing ourselves since 1988. Yeah. So,
nice. So I started it. My first thing was in 89.
Well, then maybe offline we could reminisce a little bit. But the whole, I can't really say point of our podcast, but the whole focus of our podcast is talking to people who started out as being fans of things and then developed to being creators in their own right. So can you tell us about your first experience with fandom and what does being a fan of something mean to you?
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. Probably the first thing that I was just super fanny about, that's a bad way to say that, but I was a super fan of was probably Spider-Man. And that started with the reruns of the 66 cartoon when I was a kid. They would run those after school. And then later the 80s Spider-Man and then Spider-Man and his Amazing Friends and all. But Spider-Man was my first introduction to superheroes and cartoons and also to comics, because knowing Spider-Man from the cartoon, I remember when I was very young, my mother and I were in a checkout aisle, a local supermarket, and they had three packs. They would pack three comics in a plastic bag and hang them. And there were two Spider-Mans. You couldn't see the middle one, but there were two Spider-Mans. And I remember just begging her to let me get these because I only knew Spider-Man from the cartoon.
Right.
And so I think just to shut me up, she let me get them. And it was three issues of Spider-Man in the bag, but it was three consecutive issues.
That never happens.
Yeah, I know, right? And so, because it was issues 192, 193, and 194. I still have them to this day. They are treasured pieces of my collection. And they're well-worn. I read the crap out of these things. Not only did it introduce you to the fact that Spider-Man was in comics, but that these were not three standalone stories. Things kept going. I was like, that was my introduction to like, holy crap, serialized storytelling. I didn't know what it was called then, but it was like, oh, this is cool. Now, it took about 10 years before I was able to read issue 195. So it took about 10 years to resolve that cliffhanger. But I was hooked. I mean, I was in love with the comics as a medium, as a format. So that was probably where my fandom took hold. But during the 70s, I was big at like Star Trek and $6 Million Man and Batman, the 66 Batman series. Because of these things were the things that played in the afternoons after I got home from school or during the summer when you're home and they're on during the day. And so you would watch whatever, like if you watch an episode of Star Trek and then mom says, okay, outside. And I would go outside and I would play Star Trek. That was kind of the impetus of coming up with my own stories because I wouldn't just go act out the episode I watched. I was like, okay, I might come up with something new to play based on that. And I think that's where kind of the imagination kicked in that, yeah, it's still running today.
I did the same thing with Nancy Drew when I was like in elementary school.
I got
so hooked on the Nancy Drew stories. And then my friend who was a neighbor and her brother we started doing our own Nancy Drew role-playing, you know, stories. And he had to be like the bad guy, and he had to be the boyfriends and stuff like that. And then we did the same thing with Charlie's Angels when it came out.
Yeah, I remember my love of mysteries probably started with Encyclopedia Brown. But I also remember in the 70s, we had the Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew mysteries on TV. And those were always cool because, hey, these are kids solving mysteries. And, or like Scooby-Doo, these are kids solving mysteries. It's like, as a kid myself at the time, you know, that was appealing. That it wasn't just these old people solving mysteries. Because when you're 6 or 7, anybody over the age of 20 is old, you know. Yeah, I've learned that, you know, age is that sliding scale. But yeah, so those were kind of early things that, you know, and then my love of mystery probably grew there. And then as I got older, going into the 80s, you know, Rockford Files or Magnum, those type of detective stories are still very much an influence on me because I write that kind of stuff today. And what I liked about those is sometimes the plot was less important than the characters. And I learned a lot about characters from those. Like, yeah, if Nancy Drew had a mystery that didn't really land with you, you still came back because you loved Nancy Drew. And so it was the character. I realized at that point, it was the characters that kept bringing me back, not necessarily the plot of the week. And yeah, that was kind of the first aha moment where characters were the most important thing in the story.
Yeah, talking about Scooby-Doo for a second, I actually got hooked up with the halfling because she reminded me of Velma. So I had a big fan crush on Velma from since I was a little tyke.
Nice.
I don't know, smart, it's, short girl wearing glasses, you know, and she had a pleated skirt. It, you know, what's not to love?
And hey, you know what? Out of all the Scooby-Doo characters, who gets cosplayed the most?
Yes.
This is true.
And those were, yeah, because I grew up, you know, I grew up digging Scooby-Doo. And the mysteries were, yeah, they were silly at times, but the clues were there. And that's what I always learned was how to spot clues and how to look for clues, which later, as a writer, how to write clues because, man, writing clues is hard because you don't want to make them so obvious that the reader goes, oh, I get it. But in your head, because you know it's a clue, it's like there's a giant neon sign pointing at the page going, yeah, this is a clue. And yeah, but learning those things, how they figured out what little tidbit it was, I fell in love with that. And I learned to love to play fair because, man, I hate those mysteries where the one detail that points the detective to the villain is one we as the audience didn't see.
Oh, man, that annoys the you-know-what out of me.
And me too. I absolutely hate that because I'm reading toward the end of the story when there's this big reveal that it's so-and-so, and they came out of nowhere.
Well, indubitably, Watson, it was obviously the chef because I discovered this pen that was laid into the butler's pantry. And
right. I mean,
we searched your house and found this. I'm like, well, why didn't we see you search the house?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just that always bugged me. So as a writer, I don't want to do that to my audience.
And we thank you. We thank you.
So I make it a point to play fair. If there's a clue that leads to it, I want the audience to get there first if they can. Or if they don't figure it out and the reveal happens, then they can go, aha, that's what that meant.
Right.
And want to go back and maybe reread it. Or I've had people come up to me and go, okay, I have questions. What did this clue mean? Was this a clue? And so that's really cool because some people get other things out of it than I intended. You know, because that has happened. Or the characters kind of lead things in a direction. You know, people laugh at me when I tell them. It's like, you know, my characters are smarter than I am. I have had plots where this is what's going to happen. We're going to go A, B, C, D, E. And we get to about C. And the characters go, yeah, we're going to go this way. And then it always makes for a better story. But the writer in me didn't see it coming. Which is, I know, sounds odd, but yeah, the characters really You know, I had one where it was a short story. So it was a simple story because it's a short story. Hero knows what the bad guy did, knows who the bad guy is, blah, blah, blah. We get to the end. Hero and villain confront each other. And as I'm typing it, the villain says something in the dialogue that just flows out of my fingers that makes me go, and the hero go, oh, crap, he didn't do it.
Oh.
He's not the bad guy.
Oh.
Oh, well, we're at the end of the story. Who's the bad guy? And then this other character goes, yeah, it's me. And so it's this nice twist. And I was like, oh, I like that. It's a good twist. Let me go back now and add the clues so this doesn't come out of nowhere. In my reread, I was surprised to find the clues were already there.
Oh, wow.
My subconscious obviously knew more than my conscious mind did. So the clues were coming out through the character while the back of my brain was working it out, whereas the front of my brain didn't know. And that has happened to me multiple times where characters will just say, yeah, I'm not doing that. Or let's do this. Or, you know, or, yeah, I need to die here. You know, like, no, I got three more books with you. No, this is why I need to die. But it always has the side effect of making the story better.
Right.
It doesn't make my life any easier, but it does make the story a little better.
It's a little bit like watching anime because you never know if the main character is going to survive or not.
Right. Because sometimes it's, you know, when you get into the story, because when I come up with the plot, and I don't do deep plot. I have very loose plots. I know the 10 things have to happen in the story. And basically I'll go, okay, we got to get to plot point one, start walking. And I follow the character to see how they get me there.
Mm-hmm.
And that has yielded some amazing stories where things happen in the process of writing the story that I hadn't thought of before I started, which has, like I said, has led to some very cool surprises. Well, it also makes me sound like a lunatic to people that aren't writers.
Well, I can tell you, I totally get it because we play role-playing games, tabletop mm-hmm. role-playing games, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, GURPS, whatever. And I ran a game one time that has come to be known as the Psycho Game. It's basically, I had only the barest, I mean, threadbare idea for a plot. And then everybody else within character just sort of drove it. And mm-hmm. I basically had to hold on for dear life. When somebody came up with I think it's this, I was like, okay. And then my brain starts working a little bit. And then another character would go off in this direction with the plot. And we get to the end of the game and they have come up with this story and mm-hmm. this plot that would have far outdone anything that I could have actually come up with myself. So.
Yeah, that's a great bit too with like learning character. Mm-hmm. Like I do this thing sometimes at writers' conferences or conventions where when you're talking about getting to know your characters, and this very much works in role-playing as well. If you have a very simple plot that could just be the character needs to get through that door to what's on the, or it needs to get on the other side of that door or that wall.
Mm-hmm.
There's a door, there's a window, whatever. How does your character get there? What do they do? Some characters might go kick the door in, go in guns blazing. Another character might pick the lock. Another might say, I'm going to go through the window because the door is obviously booby trapped. Those character defines that plot. And that's where story comes in. Story is, and a friend of mine, Derek Ferguson, used to say this all the time. And he was absolutely right. Story is when character and plot meet. Because you can have a plot and you can have characters and they do all their things. But the story is when those two things are, you know, you put one into the other. And like with role playing, when you say, there's a door over here, what do you do? The person you ask dictates what happens next because every character reacts differently based on who they are. And so if you write that plot with three different characters, you could come up with three vastly different stories just by what the character will do. And so that's It's a wonderful character building exercise. And yeah, role playing does it extremely well because every character, every player not only creates their characters, but they, a little bit of them is in there, and not all of us think the same. You know, we all react to problems differently. We all react to good news differently, you know? And so those things inform those characters. And so when you trust your characters, like if you've ever read anything or watched a movie or TV show and go, they're not acting right. That character's not acting like I think like they normally do. That's because they have forced that character to do something the character wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice it jumps out at you because you've gotten to know those characters.
Yeah, there have been actors or actresses that have, especially in movies, that have gone back to the director and say, no, I'm not doing that because this character would not act like that or say these things or what have you. So, yeah.
Yeah, and no matter, and if you try to force them, like I can write anything I want to in these stories. But if I write something that doesn't feel right to me, then obviously it's not going to feel right to the reader. So if I want the characters to act out of character, there's got to be a really compelling reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it can happen. I mean, you know, certainly when talking about fandom and stuff, we've certainly seen examples of heroic characters once or twice for a reason doing unheroic things. And we buy it in that one thing because they've set that up.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, the three that always pop into my head from that one, there's the Deep Space Nine episode in the Pale Moonlight where Sisko has done, and I'm going to spoil some like 30, 40 year old shows here. Sorry.
Spoiler alert.
We've been sit over the pandemic, so we're good.
Yeah. So where Sisko has lied and cheated and done basically stuff that could have been considered war crimes to get the Romulans into the war on their side. And he does all these things because they're necessary and it's important, but he does a lot of morally questionable things. That was one that always jumps out at me. There's a Stargate one episode where I forget the title, but it's one where Rene Auberjonois is the villain. And we find out they meet them and they think they're under attack from this enemy and they're there to help them. And they find out that these guys are basically space Nazis and they're the ones that are trying to wipe out.
I remember that episode. Yes. I remember that episode.
And at the end of the episode, they're running out back through the Stargate and he says, don't follow us. Cause they've already shown that if the iris is closed and you come through, you're going to die.
Right.
And so O'Neill steps through and he knows this guy's coming and he's going to come through the gate and he steps on the other side and just says, close it. And he knows this guy's going to die.
Right.
And it's a morally questionable thing we're not used to seeing him do to commit a cold-blooded act. But it's earned because of everything they've went through in the episode. And the third one is there's a Magnum PI that's like that, where it's a great two-parter where we find out that when they were captured in Vietnam, one of Magnum's buddies was brainwashed and turned into a sleeper agent. Mm-hmm. And now all these years later, they have activated him to commit murder.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, the villain is going to get away because he is a diplomat. So he's got immunity. So they've labeled him undesirable and told him he has to leave the country and can't come back. But he's going to get away with it. And Magnum and his other friends, we can't allow that happen. And they actually stop this guy on their way to the airport and they're talking and they know they've met obviously. And then, because this is a guy who tortured them years ago. And he's like, I know you, I'm unarmed. You won't kill me unless I'm trying to kill you. And he starts to walk away. And the last minute, Magnum shoots him and kills him as he's walking away, which is a very out of character thing for the character. But again, it was earned in the story.
Right.
So it didn't feel out of character. Now, if he'd have been doing that every episode, then you'd kind of go, but
right.
So a lot of times, if you're going to do something out of character, have a reason for it, make it compelling. And your audience, if they love these characters, will follow those characters through that. So, yeah. Sorry, that was a long-winded way to answer that. So sorry.
It's okay.
That led me to another question, though. One of the things that I've noticed is that some authors write stories and some authors write characters. Do you believe that's a fair characterization?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, like I said, there's different ways of telling a story. There is a story-driven plot where the story is the most important thing. The characters are important, but telling the story is the most important thing. There are other stories where the characters are more important. So while the plot is still important, and I don't ever want to say the plot's not important, but the plot is less important than how the characters respond to the plot. So it's different ways. I mean, I'm trying to think of some good examples, but a story where like the plot is someone is planning to assassinate the president of the United States and we've got to stop them. You know, that can be, if all it is a bunch of characters trying to stop this, that's more of a plot driven story. But if we focus on one or two characters, even though a bunch of characters are doing it, like In the Line of Fire is a good example of that one.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big story, but we focus on this one guy.
Yeah.
So it's personal to him. So now, even though it could be a plot-driven story, it's now a character-driven story because everything that happens in the plot, we're seeing how this guy responds to it, okay. How this guy reacts to it. And so that makes it more character-driven as opposed to it's just, you know, it could be five or six different characters trying to stop something. So,
right.
Yeah. So tying it to how a main character reacts to something kind of makes it a little more character-driven.
Okay.
And I think TV does that really, really well. Like, you know, pick your favorite show. Like we were talking about Stargate earlier. You love those characters. Not every episode's a winner. But you come back next week because you love those characters and you love seeing what they do.
We are massive Stargate SG-1 fans.
Yeah.
I mean, love it.
Yeah.
One of my goals, I've pitched the publisher that has the license, I've pitched like three things to them over the years and none of them have ever landed, but it's one of my goals.
One day.
I'd love to write at least one Stargate story.
All right.
Well, you will have to let us know if that
we
happens.
Will. Yes, we will because we will be the first ones in line.
Yes.
Yeah. Cause I do some, like tie-in work. I love it. It's so much fun. It's like getting to play with your buddy's toys, you know?
Right.
Because they're not yours. But yeah, you just kind of get to take them out, play with them for a little while, and then try not to break them.
Right. Speaking of playing with other people's toys, how in the world did you get the rights to write the Green Hornet?
Oh, well, I didn't get the rights. The publisher did.
Oh, okay.
A lot of these characters that are, you know, like that, usually how high-end fiction works is the company that owns the characters will license them to a publisher for whatever dollars and what it is. But, all of those are different depending on the popularity of the characters or, you know, that kind of thing. So like the Star Trek license probably costs more than the Green Hornet license, that kind of thing.
I would imagine. Yeah.
But yeah, they will license it out. And so the publisher, in this case with Green Hornet, it was Moonstone Books.
Mm-hmm.
The publisher will buy the license and you're basically renting or leasing the license and says, you know, and I think it's a year, maybe it's 2 years at a time, whatever it is. And you then can re-up it. And they do that. And then the way I got involved was I was already doing some work for Moonstone. I was writing some Domino Lady stuff. And I think I'd written some one or two other things. Because they do a lot of old pulp characters as well.
And mm-hmm.
So they were doing Green Hornet and they were like, would you like to write a Green Hornet story? Now, the Green Hornet license, this is where sometimes licenses get tricky. There are multiple licenses for multiple characters. The Green Hornet started in radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then went to TV and was in comics and was in books. Those are different licenses. So Moonstone had the license to the radio show and the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So we were allowed to use anything that appeared in those. If it only appeared in the comics or the novels, we weren't allowed to use it. Those were a different license. That's why the books rarely used the people like Casey and the detective. And so it was that kind of thing. So we had that license. You usually get a Bible that says, here's what you can do. Here's what you can't do. Here's what we don't want to see. Because sometimes the licensor can go, we don't want stories that do this. No stories where the Green Hornet gets shot. That kind of, or whatever. They may have other stuff in production we don't know about, or we've seen that story. We just don't want to do that story anymore. That kind of thing.
Right.
And so they send you this Bible. You read the Bible. You write a pitch, because doing a license tie-in, you not only have to pitch to the publisher and the editor and publisher sign off on it, you still have the people that own the license have to approve it. And they can come in and go, yeah, we don't like this. We don't like this guy, or we don't like this guy's story. No. And so even if the publisher liked it, you may not get to because the licensor didn't, or vice versa. So there's extra steps. And so
Right. There's
less of that, what I talked about earlier, where changing stuff later in the story.
Mm-hmm.
There's less of that in tie-in fiction because you have to stick to the approved plot you sent them, the approved pitch you sent them. So yeah, so you get to do that, and there's, you know, there's, like I said, you get a Bible, here's what you can do, what you can't do, and, you know, and then if it's something that's pre-existing, I rent out and I watch it or read it. At the time, there was no way to legally watch the Green Hornet TV series. I did find some places that had, like, where you could buy, like, a DVD of them, mm-hmm. you know, where someone had recorded them off TV. So I got those, and I watched those, and because you want to get the character sounding right, and how, you know, how they act, and how the mannerisms, all that stuff. Because there's a lot of those things that, you know, just like they do in the TV show, Let's Roll Kato needs to be in there somewhere, because that's in every episode, and so that kind of stuff. And so you research it that way, and you do it, and then you send it to the publisher, and it goes through edits, and then they send it up the chain to the license holder, and they give it a polish, and they can either go, ugh, we really don't like that, or that doesn't work with established lore. Because sometimes it can be that. You write something, then they go, no. We've established he's an only child. You can't give him a sister.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. Right. So,
unlike Spock, you can't give him a sister.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And tie-in fiction, too. It's like, I always use Star Trek as an example when people ask about writing tie-in fiction. The original series, especially, and the next generation, mostly, starts with them on the bridge. Life is good. A boatload of bad things happen. We solve the problem. The end of the episode, we're all on the bridge, happy and flying off to our next adventure. That's media tie-in writing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't break those toys. I can't kill Spock unless Spock's alive at the end of the episode. I can't blow up the Black Beauty and the Green Hornet unless I've repaired the Black Beauty at the end of it, you know. Mm-hmm. A buddy of mine, Sean Taylor, said this once in a panel, and it always stuck with me. He says, the rule is this, don't blow up Cleveland. We may need that later. And that's always stuck with me when it comes to doing tie-in fiction. I'm just telling a story, and I can't break anything. If I break it, I bought it.
Right.
And so, yeah. But knowing that going in, because it doesn't, I've heard some people say, doesn't that limit your creativity because you can't just do what you want? And I don't think it does, because I think because you have those constraints of I can't do this and I can't do that, you have to be more creative to tell a compelling story within that smaller, you know, box of whatever you can do. And I've been doing it a while, so I've kind of learned that what I do is the first five ideas I get, I just ignore them. Because they're probably the five easiest ideas that popped into my head, which means I'm probably not the only person that thought of that idea.
Sure.
So I usually tend to throw those out and then come at it from a point of what are the characters doing? So that's where I always start with. What are the characters doing? Like almost every first line of every book I've written or every story I've written starts with the character's name and then what they're doing or what they're feeling.
Okay.
Like Bobby Nash was having a great day.
Right.
Line two. Then all hell broke loose. So I always like to get into their head, see where they're at, and then drop the character and go, okay, I want to do this. Great. If I drop Zorro into this story, what happens? And then, you know, and some of them, when there are that, they're tied to certain either time periods or like the Green Hornet is in the 60s.
Right.
Because we were writing the TV show, so it had to be set in the 60s. So there were no cell phones. So you have to make sure you're sticking to that world, you know, doing Zorro. It had to be in that time period where Spanish California and that era. And so you work it in to make sure that the plots fit the era. But then what kind of story do I get when I drop that character into that plot? And that's where the fun comes in, is trying to figure out what to do with those. Because again, I can't vastly change the characters. So I have to get to know the characters, and so that they can act, you know, in how they act. Yes.
Well, I want to kind of get back to your journey, because I think our listeners are very interested in how people got from their starting point to where they are now. With that in mind, what would you say was your starting point for your career?
Ooh.
And what was the first thing you did after you decided, okay, I'm going to be a writer?
Well, the first thing I ever had that was printed, you know, we did some stuff in high school with the, not the newspaper, but like a literary journal.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a couple of those, and I wrote some stuff for those. So that was technically, I guess, my first published work. I did some small, like, stuff with some friends. We were making comics, and you go out and we'd sell them at conventions. They weren't getting a wide distribution, but we were selling them local and things like that. And I did comic strips for a kids magazine that was a monthly insert in the local newspaper. And I did those for 12 years.
Oh, wow.
So once a month for 12 years, I did comic strips. So those were fun. Those were cool. But my first quote unquote professional, like where someone paid me, I remember I was working a job that I absolutely just was ready to get away. You know, it was not fun. I was just miserable. And I go home one night. So I remember it was a Friday night, and I had just had the most miserable week at work. And I went home on Friday night, and I was living alone at this time. I was in my early 20s. Anyways, I go home one Friday night, and I get on the internet, and this was back in the dial-up days. So after waiting to get through, I looked up. I was like, I got to make something happen. I've got to get some work. I've got to write something. So I go to every comic book, and this was before I'd ever thought about doing a novel, by the way. It's just, I'm a comic writer. I got to find a company who will hire me. So I went to every comic book publisher, no matter how big, no matter how small, that had a website. If they had an email address, I emailed them. I said, here's who I am. Here's what I've done. Yes, I was very naive. It was very foolish to think that would, you know, but I did this. And I think I probably sent off 60 emails. Like I said, some of these were very small publishers, but I sent off about 60 emails. I received one reply. And it was a reply from this company that says, thank you, you know, for showing us what you've done and all this. And unfortunately, we are actually a very small publisher, and we're actually shuttering, but thank you. And I was like, okay. So, well, that was a bust, and I went on about my life. About a year later, I get an email from that same guy and says, hey, our book is coming back with this other publisher. Are you still interested in trying out? Our writer's not following us. Are you interested in? Well, actually, it was Scripter, because the artist was also the owner of the character, and so he plotted it.
Okay.
And so I would write the script based on his plot and art. And he's like, sure. And so I did a couple of issues. Like, there was a 2-issue story I did on spec as kind of a tryout. And they liked it, and they hired me. And so suddenly I had a professionally printed book in my hand, which helps you at the next level. Because if you go up to a publisher or an editor and you're talking to them and you say, hi, I'm a writer. And they're like, the first question is, what have you written? Almost always the first question they're going to ask. And if you start going, well, I'm kind of working on my first book now, and it's coming along, you know, and we all kind of fumble over that. You can literally see the glaze go over their eyes, you know.
Yeah.
And because really it is a catch-22. Nobody wants to be the first person to hire you, but nobody wants to hire you if you don't have experience.
Right.
But if you go up and you talk to a publisher or an editor and they say, what have you written? And you put a book in their hands, you've earned a minute, because the first thing they're going to do is flip it over. They're going to look back, they're going to flip through some pages, especially if it's a comic, they're going to flip through, check out the art. You've bought yourself a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had that. So that allowed me to find a little bit more comic work. At this point, I was working on what would be my first published novel. And so, same thing. And when you're published in comics and you write a novel, you're still a newbie writer. Because I talked to several people. It's like, oh, I've been published for years doing this. And they're like, yeah, that didn't count. Because it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
So writing comics and writing novels, publishers were like, yeah, those are apples and oranges. Because you can do one doesn't mean you can do the other. But I sold my first novel to a truly horrible publisher. They're not in business anymore, but I signed a contract for 7 years. They had my book, put the book out with the most horrendous cover ever known to me. And it was a miserable experience from start to finish. But, you know, I had a book in my hand.
Yeah.
And so I used that book to talk to other publishers. So having the book, even though the experience was horrible on the personal and business side of things, I was able to get work at other publishers doing stuff.
Right.
Because I had this book. And so, yes, getting the experience, having something tangible helps. And so it was kind of a stepping stone. And so I was doing work that way. Now it's a little easier today because you can actually self-publish your own book and show that to publishers because you've got something in your hand. Wasn't really an option when I started,
right?
Like it is today. The attitude toward doing it yourself, publishing, is more accepting than it was, you know, back when I was starting. Back then, it just meant, oh, you're not good enough to get hired by a real publisher. So, you know, you're just doing it yourself. Whereas now people are like, no, you're an entrepreneur, you're a small business owner. It's more accepting. And really, that's what writing almost is. Or any creating, you're pretty much a small business owner. What you guys do, you're technically a small business. And
I don't know if we would even go that far.
No, Halfling. And despite the fact that, you know, we're doing this because we love the community, we have to approach it like a business. You have to be structured. You have to have deadlines. And you have to get out there and you have to meet people and you have to network. So,
And that means doing it when you don't feel like it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was so,
you know, that was a game changing realization for me because before I was published, I wrote when I felt like it. And that doesn't work these days. Now I'm here at this desk at least 6 or 7 days a week, mostly 7 days a week. You know, it may not be all day, all seven of them, but I'm at this desk doing something. But also to your point, I mean, you're doing it like a business, but you're also doing all the other things. Like you don't just record a podcast and you're done. You've got to do the editing. You've got to do the production. You've got to do the cover art. You've got to do the promotion, the marketing. You're going to conventions. You're talking to potential guests. You know, sometimes you could be talking to potential sponsors or there's all kinds of stuff that goes with that. I wish I had known when I was in college because I would have taken more business classes.
That's one of the things that we've talked to about with a lot of specifically writers, but pretty much everybody. They talk about the hustle. And a lot of people getting into anything creative, but especially writing, they don't necessarily comprehend the amount of hustle because publishers just don't do for you what they used to. And so you have to do it for yourself. Actually, you have to do it for them.
I have talked with publishers now when I'm talking to them about doing something. One of the questions they will ask me is, what is your marketing plan? Because they don't send you on book tours anymore. They don't, you know, they promote you when the book's available for the bookstores to order it. They promote it the day it comes out. And then they're on to the next book. It's really up to us as creators to do all that. Because really, who cares more about our product than us anyway?
Absolutely.
All right.
So we're out beating the bushes. Like I said, Evil Ways came out in 2005. Here we are in 2023. I still promote Evil Ways all these years later because it's still on sale. I take it with me to conventions, all these things that I'm doing just to kind of get the word out there. But yeah, there's a lot that goes into the, you know, oddly enough, the writing is probably the least thing I do time-wise. Probably like recording is probably the least thing you do time-wise.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's all this other stuff that's important, that you have to do. But when I'm doing admin work, I'm not writing.
Right.
But it's all part of the business of getting these things done, because I'm a one-man band for the most part. I mean, I have cover artists and I have editors and stuff to, that take some of the burden of things that help. But I mean, from the business side, I'm a one-man band. I'm writing the press kits. I'm writing the press releases. I'm updating the website. I'm posting on social media. Mm-hmm. I'm setting up my convention appearances. I'm ordering books. I'm doing all that stuff because it's part of the business. And that's where treating it like a job really came in handy, because I had to learn how to structure that, because you can get so wrapped up in all this other stuff that has to be done. And you realize, I've worked 10 hours today and I haven't written a thing. And yeah. And so, you know,
I want to circle back to the comic book. Was that your big break, or do you consider another one of your works to be your big break? The thing that really got you established?
The comic was a break. I don't know if it was a big break, because it didn't lead to a lot of work. I think probably the book that came out that was probably the biggest break was Evil Ways, my first novel,
mm-hmm.
my first published novel. Because up until from like 89 to 2004 when I sold Evil Ways, or 2000 when I started writing the comic, I was working, but it was sporadic. It was here and there. It wasn't a lot. It was just, you know, there was a little here, a little there. When I sold Evil Ways in 2004, it came out in 2005, and I have not slowed down since 2005. So my career probably got a bigger boost from Evil Ways than it did from the Demon Slayer comic.
Okay.
Plus, I didn't own the comic, so there wasn't a lot I could do outside of, I wrote this and I promoted that I wrote this. But I couldn't control when it came out. I didn't have any control over any of that. And it came out kind of sporadically. But whereas the novel, I own it. Well, the publisher at the time had a bit too. But it's my characters. It's my work. I own it. I can talk it up or share it. And when my contract was up, I did not renew it. I took it elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's kind of where my self-publishing journey started, was with Evil Ways. Because once I got my rights back, now, it was 7 years, so I had been doing stuff for other publishers.
Right.
When I got the rights back to Evil Ways, I shopped it around to other publishers, and I didn't find anybody that was interested we were on the same page. There were a couple that were interested, but they wanted to do some stuff I didn't care for
mm-hmm.
in terms of design or whatever. You know? And so at that point, the self-publishing Create Space, you know, which is now Amazon, now yeah. owns that.
Right.
I decided to, just to keep it out there, release it myself. And really, there was no plan on self-publishing beyond that. I was quite content to write it, give it to somebody else, let them worry about covers, let mm-hmm. them worry about edits. I wanted Evil Ways out, so I did that. And so eventually I said, I do want to write the sequel, so I did that. And so then I wrote something else that uses some of the same characters. I said, well, those don't need to be at different publishers, so I'll do that. And then something similar happened with the Snow books. I had written it for a publisher, and then they went under, and I got the rights back. And it was like, I could retool it, or, you know, why don't you do it myself?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where my own publishing company started. And it was not something I planned. I just kind of fell into it. But yeah, no, I probably got a lot more traction out of Evil Ways than just about anything in those early days. Huh. Now, there have been stuff after where you do something for a larger publisher that gets more eyes on you or stuff. But yeah, like I said, as crappy as that publishing experience was, had I not done it, I don't know if the other stuff would have happened, because there's a clear line of Evil Ways led to this, which led to this, which, you know.
Right, right. Well, what would you say has been the biggest challenge for you over the course of your career? And what have you done, or what did you do to overcome that challenge?
Well, probably the biggest hurdle I face every day is me. Man, getting me to sit down and get started working is the hardest thing to do every day. Especially if I get on the internet, I'm screwed. So
don't go to TV Tropes.
Yeah. Oh God, don't go to YouTube.
Yeah.
So once I get started, I'm fine. But in terms of the career, I didn't have a clear plan. I didn't, when I started, I didn't have a plan. I just mm-hmm. was like, I didn't know. Again, most of this stuff was self-taught. So, you know, my thought was a publisher hires you, they'll just keep hiring you.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily the case. Or just because you got a book, other opportunities will just naturally flow to you. That's not always the case. You still have to get out and do the networking, get to know people. Now, that was then. I've been in this a while now.
Yeah.
So I've worked with enough publishers now that sometimes things will come to me and go, hey, we're doing this. Would you be interested in being part of it?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's how the Zorro thing happened or the Green Hornet thing, where it's like, hey, we're doing Green Hornet short stories. Would you be interested? We'll pay you X amount of dollars for a short story. And I'm like, great, pays the phone bill. You know,
right.
So there's, again, that small business mindset sometimes kicking in. But yeah, so stuff like that, it's like the challenge is you have to keep getting yourself out there. Like Roger said, the hustle.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get people to know you. Even after all these years, I still feel like I'm hand selling almost every book because every day I'm posting stuff to social media. I'm going on podcasts. I'm doing conventions. And when I see bumps and things, oh, I talked about that on social media yesterday. Obviously somebody saw it and goes, oh, that looks interesting. And they bought a book, that kind of thing. So I still feel like I'm doing that. People aren't just like in droves. Unlike Stephen King, millions of people are not waiting patiently for my book to hit and then pouncing on it. I have to like point them to it. Yes.
Well, at least now you can say you know the Halfling and the Spaceman. And
yeah.
There you go. See?
That and $5 will get you some coffee at Starbucks.
Right. But I'm sure there are people listening to your podcast who have never heard of me.
Absolutely.
So if nothing else, if they go and at least go to my website and look, it may not be to their liking, but at least, but you never know. They may go, oh, that sounds interesting. Let me, you know. And yeah. So, yes, it's one of those things. You do whatever you can to get in front of people and doing events and things like, and I love that stuff too. So that helps. I love, as you guys notice, I like to talk,
you know, and we like to talk to people. So that works out perfect.
It's a good mix.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's good to have podcast guests that talk. I used to co-host a podcast and we had a few guests on over the years that you ask them a question and go, yeah.
Very monosyllabic.
You kind of need to, give me some more. And,
right.
So, yeah. But those were the kind of hurdles early on. I didn't realize, like, you know, there's always that talk about breaking into the business.
Mm-hmm.
That before anybody's ever sold anything, that it's almost like a magical thing of breaking into the business. And I'd say, so what happens after you break into the business with your first sale? And it's almost kind of disheartening to tell them that then you have to break in again.
Mm-hmm.
Because having one book does not necessarily mean that the next one's going to be easier to sell. You still have to the publishing industry is weird. It seems, and I don't know if it's they do this on purpose, but it seems like they seem like they're actively trying not to hire people. I mean, because you really, they make you jump through a lot of hurdles. And there's a lot of, you know.
Yeah.
Now, granted, every publisher has their guidelines or what they're looking for. Not every publisher publishes the same type of thing. So, you know, doing your research comes in handy. So those are the type of things that over the years have been hurdles of getting through the wall to talk to someone at the publisher. And, you know, it gets a little easier when you have a nice resume or I've done these things. Winning awards helps, or I've done this, or other things I've done, you know, has helped and, you know, kind of get you through the door to at least talk to a person.
I have a question for the Halfling. Did you make people jump through hoops like that when you were editing Crimson Streets? No, really?
No.
How sadistic were you?
I would not use the word sadistic, but, you know, I mean, Crimson Streets was a horse of a different color. Because the big thing for Crimson Streets was that we were providing a venue for writers who were just getting started and looking for a place to get their work put out. So I was pretty liberal in the stories that we accepted. There were definitely some that I had to turn down, and I tried to give constructive criticism about, but no, I would not have used the words.
I would prefer to imagine you with your magic staff just banging the table because people are not writing right. Why are you not writing right?
Well, I think that that's a good thing too, because see, as you said, their goal, they were looking for new writers.
Mm-hmm.
When you get up to certain sized publishers, I won't say levels because that's a different thing, but size. Mm-hmm. You get up to a larger publisher, there are a lot of people that are submitting that are not polished yet.
Mm-hmm.
Like some people think my first book should be sold to Simon & Schuster. And while that can happen, you know, like me, I learned a lot working for smaller publishers and kind of step laddered up a little bit. And I still work for small publishers too. So I'm not knocking small publishers. I love small publishers. You're allowed to be a little more creative, I think, because smaller publishers are more willing to experiment with things or try something new or try something different. But when you get up to a certain sized publisher, they want people that are polished, have a bit of a backlog or have a following or have the, and so as a newer writer, it is hard to get past that entry point.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And yeah. And these days, like you have to know when is a good time to approach them. These days, never submit anything in December. Publishers that I've talked to, publishers hate December because people do NaNoWriMo and submit their first draft thinking it's done because they wrote it in November. It's like, no, that's your first draft. Now go polish it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And not everybody does that. So they get inundated with first drafts in December. The editors then have to turn it back, you know, turn it down because it's not ready.
Okay.
Yeah. So that kind of thing. There's those ins and outs. And, you know, because I think, you know, I've never done that because I do this every day all year long. I've never done that NaNoWriMo thing, but it is pretty cool to write a story quick. And I've done that. But I once wrote a 100,000 word novel in 3 months. Wow. I'll never do that again.
Whoa.
I did it for a publisher on a tight deadline early in my career. I will never do it again that quick, but it was, oh, but yeah. I mean, that was like, I ate, slept, read, and I worked a full-time job. And
my goodness.
So yeah, that one about killed me. That was rough. And yeah, but those are the things that, yeah, like I said, it's not like they're actually going, we don't want to hire people. The publishers want you to be as polished as possible.
Right.
When you submit to them.
Be ready. Yeah. But,
yeah,
you know, we've talked a little bit about where you started. We talked how you got your big break. You got your first break and then your big break and how you developed that. Can you tell us about anything you've got going on that's coming up? Anything you're excited about?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, there's always, like I said, this is my job now. So there's always stuff in the pipeline. I do balance between working for publishers and doing my own stuff. I have several things that are at publishers that'll come out eventually. I just don't know when. Again, sometimes small press moves a little slow. The pandemic did not help. So there's a lot of stuff that's in production of at some stage that I just don't know about, comics and novels and whatever. But I just had recently come out, Valhalla Books launched the first two books in a horror Western series I'm doing for them. These are novellas, so they're shorter, like the, I find small press is great, like those, the paperbacks we read in the 70s that were a couple hundred pages, you know, 150, whatever. So we're doing that. And so it's a horror Western. So they released the first two books together, and then we'll do a book a year going forward, as long as it sells.
Mm-hmm.
So that just came out. I have a story, and this is what I'm very excited about. I have a story in the Kolchak the Night Stalker 50th anniversary hardcover. Kolchak's cool. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So I've gotten to write Kolchak twice. The first one, I co-wrote a story with Paul Kupperberg, and there's two different versions of Kolchak. This was the modern day where it's like Kolchak in 2023, or it was 2022 when I wrote it. So Kolchak has a cell phone and he can't use it. Doesn't know how to use it, but he has it. That kind of thing. So it's modern day. The anniversary one is set during the timelines of the books, the TV show.
Mm-hmm. So back in the 70s, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I got to write a story that was set before he goes to work for the paper. He was a war correspondent in Vietnam. So I wrote a story that takes place while he's doing that in Vietnam, which was a lot of
fun. Oh, that sounds
good. And yeah, cool. So I got a lot of research of Vietnamese folklore.
Yeah.
You know, monsters and whatnot that's, you know, right. in their folklore. And yeah, that was fun. I had a blast doing that. That was cool. And so those are out now. There's always snow books coming up. I am working on book 7 of that series now. There'll be the third Sheriff Myers book called Standing on the Shadows will be out sometime later this year. And those are all kind of things. Those are books I do myself that are kind of that crime thriller actiony kind of thing. And they're all part of this same world with Evil Ways and Deadly Games. And so they all live in the same world. So sometimes secondary characters cross over. And like Sheriff Myers, for instance, started in Evil Ways. He was a secondary character in Evil Ways. He was a character who wouldn't let me go. He kept knocking on the back of my head going, when do I get my story?
Mm.
And so finally a story clicked that he was perfect for. And so now we're doing a series with him. And so things like that are always coming. I know at some point this year, there's more Domino Lady coming, both prose and comics from Moonstone. I don't know in-store dates yet, but I wrote a 6-book comic series for a educational publisher called Abdo. They do a lot of stuff for libraries as well. And it's 6 standalone comics. It's crime fiction set during actual historic events.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, so they gave me 6 historic events that I do a fictional crime story during that event. And then we do real facts about the event at the end of the book. And so one of them was like the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, the blackout in New York in 1977 during the Son of Sam stuff. One happens on the Titanic. One happens during Hurricane Katrina. One happens during the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And one happens during the explosion of Mount St. Helens.
Wow.
There's a lot, very research heavy.
Okay. So,
yeah, because you want the real facts. Because the crime story is fake and the characters are made up, but the other stuff had to be real. And, you know, to come up with 6 different crimes, like I didn't want each one to just be a theft, you know. I came up with 6 different crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so those have been written. They're with the artist now, so I don't know when those will come out. Those were fun. And yeah, so there's always new stuff. I'd like to do more tie-in stuff. That's always fun. Yeah.
Well, that leads us to our basic wrap-up question is, where can people find out about you and where can they get your work?
Oh, okay. Well, bobbynash.com is my website. There's links to everything there. I have an Amazon author page you can get to. So almost everything's on Amazon. We do hardcovers, paperbacks, ebooks, audiobooks. There are the stuff I publish through Ben Books myself are on KDP Select. So if you're, or Kindle Unlimited, sorry, Kindle Unlimited. So if you subscribe to that, you can read any of the stuff that I do myself through Ben Books for free.
Mm-hmm.
I also have an online store that you can get to through bobbynash.com. It's a Squareside store where you can buy autographed books directly from me. If there's a book I haven't uploaded there yet, you can always just contact me and go, do you have this? And if you have PayPal, I can do that as well. So I do stuff like that. And if you buy stuff from me, I tend to draw on your envelopes, which... about the only drawing I do these days. Yes, the people at the post office love it. It's become a thing. So it's, yeah, something I did just for fun once turned into a, yeah. But I love it. I love doing the art. So that's a lot of fun. And you can see those are all on the website too, because I'll take a photo and put them up. And those are fun. So I've had people buy stuff for me online just to get the art. They don't charge for that. That's just a freebie I taught, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, and so I'm there. I'm on all the social medias. I have at Bobby Nash on Twitter, at Bobby Nash Writes on Instagram, author Bobby Nash on Facebook. I have a Patreon page. It's patreon.com/Bobby Nash. I do a lot of serialized work there, novels that are in progress. Like right now, the 7th Snow Book, they get a chapter a week. Deadly Deals, they get a chapter a week.
Oh, okay.
Plus, if you're in the $5 and up tier, you get the ebook of the month-ish club because I ran a backstop. So now it's not every month. Sometimes I just don't have stuff. But at $5, if you don't mind scrolling through a few years worth, there's an ebook of almost everything I've done on there.
Okay.
So yeah, you could get the whole catalog for $5 if you're quick. If you get all that in a month. So I have that. So I try to post stuff there. I do a writing blog almost every day and stuff like that. And, yeah, so that's me. I have a Pinterest page. I think it's Pinterest at Bobby Nash. And all, I'm out there. Yeah, I've had to ease off with some. Like, I haven't done TikTok or some of those. I have an idea for a TikTok one. I created this town in County Summersville, which, like, Snow and Sheriff Myers is the sheriff of that town, and evil ways took place in that town. And I thought about doing one of those. Remember the old Unsolved Mysteries where Robert Stack would be
standing
in a location and go, this is the corner where, and I thought about going, because I based a lot of this fictional town on the town I live in. I thought about doing that and going to just places that I used or I set scenes in the novel in a fictionalized version of that and just doing little 5-minute Unsolved Mysteries of my books and go, yes, on this corner, this is where this happened. And blah, yeah. That's what I'd like to do, but that takes time planning and, you know.
Yeah.
And you're going to need a fedora and a trench coat.
Probably, yes. Yes. All right. And I got to work on the voice too, because it's going to be a little bit of a deeper voice, because, you know, my high-pitched Southern accent doesn't quite convey the Unsolved Mystery part like Robert Stack's deep voice. Right. But stuff like that's always fun. But I do a lot of stuff on social media. I post. I don't just post ads. I post, you know, for my books. I do what I'm watching on TV, what I'm reading, things like that. I love to share, and I share other people's stuff. And so I try to make it more, it's not just a buy my book site, because people get annoyed with those. So.
All right. We'll have to quit begging people for Patreon support then. Well, Bobby, thank you so much for coming on today and talking with us. We've had a great, great time. And thank you for telling us about your journey. And I'm hoping that other people can find inspiration in the things that you have done.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I guess if I had to boil it down, this would have been a much shorter podcast, but I've just done this. If you boil it down, it's like, just don't give up. Have fun with it. And then if you want to be a writer, you can be a writer. It doesn't have to be your career if you don't want it to be. You know, I know a lot of people that don't want to go through this is their job. They're happy with what they do. They want to write for fun. And that is absolutely a viable thing. So decide what you want your career, your trajectory with writing to be, and then do it and have fun with it. And I think, it'd be a lot of good. See, I could have boiled that down to a 5-minute podcast.
Well, we want to thank all our listeners for tuning in today, and we hope that you've all been enjoying and have become perhaps inspired by Bobby Nash. And we want to give Bobby a huge thank you again for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, I've had a blast. Thank you so much.
And this is the Spaceman of the Halfling and the Spaceman. Over and out.
Greetings, fellow travelers. This is the Halfling, with a few missives about the Halfling and Spaceman. As you may have already noticed, we've updated our episode naming convention to focus on guests along with their discipline. In short, we're dropping the phrasing, a conversation with, from the episode titles. But don't worry, our format is still going to feature the same type of banter and repartee we're known for. Over the next few weeks, the Spaceman will be updating old episodes to use the new names. In addition, we're going to be adding the occasional shorter episode featuring only Spaceman and myself, where we talk about things related to the podcast and fandom, just between the two of us. These episodes will be called Second Breakfast with the Halfling and the Spaceman. They'll be scattered among our regular content. Finally, we're adopting a more structured season schedule with 2 23-episode seasons per year, with a week break in the spring and fall, and a 2-week break in the summer and for winter holiday. We want to thank you for taking this journey with us, and we look forward to facing the future filled with the spirit of adventure, alongside our guests and listeners. We wish you clear skies and calm seas for all your journeys in active fandom.
This is the Spaceman. If you enjoy our content and want to hear more from fans about their journeys in active fandom, please don't forget to subscribe. Consider supporting us at patreon.com/halflingandspaceman. If you or someone you know is active in speculative fiction or adjacent fandoms, or an associated creator or maker who would like to share your journey with others, contact us at info@halflingandspaceman.com. Please refer to our show notes for links to the various publications, organizations, and conventions mentioned in our show. All sound effects used in this recording are under license, and opinions expressed by guests of the Halfling and Spaceman are their own and may not reflect opinions, attitudes, or positions of the host of this podcast.